said that a manifold with a given matrix for the full spacetime is can, after some judicial choice of hypersurfaces, be seen now instead of a full spacetime manifold with a metric GAB as one where it's composed through a series or by a series of space-like hypersurfaces, each one endowed with a three-dimensional metric or a three-metric GIJ, and the stack of them together with some choice for four arbitrary functions, elapse and shift, have exactly the same information of this. We have to be slightly careful in doing that because it could very be that our choices on elapse and shift can only let us explore a portion or a subset of the original manifold. So that's something that we are going to have to worry about. And this will perhaps guide also our choice of elapse and elapse and shift functions to try to cover at least the region of space that we want to get answers from. And that might come at the cost of actually giving up, not covering the full space-time, but only the region of interest. So that's, these are the things that we're going to have to discuss, and different issues will come in. So what I want to do now is to walk you through the main points. I mean, this is a long document. It's, as I said, it's very verbose. You can just reproduce every single step there with all the information that's given. So I'm not going to cover all of them because it's sufficiently large. But it's, as I said, it's very exhaustive. It has every single calculation spelled out, how you have to go from one step to the next one. But we're going to do that. We're going to use now this infrastructure, or this arena that we created, to find out what and how we have to reinterpret this equation in this front. So we want to know what is it, the equations that now this GIJ will obey, which before we had a GAB that obey Einstein's equations. Here we want to know what is it, what is the structure that this splitting that we have introduced will induce when we try to see what is the equivalent of Einstein's equations in this framework. So just say, to firm up a little bit of the notation and some results that will come in handy, I'll introduce the main tools that you need to have control on to go from one into the other one. So let me just change slightly the notation we've been using. We were using the slices labeled by T. Let me just label it by tau. We're going to introduce T later on, and because we're going to use it to express derivatives with respect to a given coordinate, we just want to detach this tau for the time being from that choice. So we said, well, surfaces, these space-like surfaces are defined by values of this tau being constant. We can always make sense of the norm, which is a covariant vector or a covector defined by just the gradient of that constant function tau. And that defines the norm, the one form omega A. And we can prove easily, just because this is a scalar function, that the gradient of this omega is symmetric, so that the nabla of omega b is equal to 0. And we want to associate a vector that has unit norm to this one, as we discussed yesterday, which is this na. And then the normalization factor is this last factor that we introduced yesterday. And so this is precisely this unit normal vector that we defined, and we associated to that unit normal vector, we may want to define, once we define these hypersurfaces, depending on how they are, they might have an associated acceleration, just because these slices might be stacking on top of each other in slightly different manners, and therefore there would be an associated acceleration. So again, let me just contrast that with the standard, say, flats space-time point of view, where this unit normal NA would just be equal to d dt and 0 here. Let me just kind of make the analogy with the special relativity. The shift, the lapse, was 1 in that case, or we can choose other ones, but in the standard way of doing things, the shift is 0, the lapse is 1. Therefore, and because the N is just a straight trivial vector as we go along, then there is no acceleration with respect to when we see there are no changes in this n as we move up and then in along the normal. That, now that we are dealing with slices and maybe curve, that no longer holds. So we're going to have to consider the possibility that there is an acceleration, which will define the acceleration of the normal observers. These observers that go along the normal direction are often referred to as the normal observers. And typically, this has very little to do with our intuition of us being observers, because we see no curvature around us for all intents and purposes. This guy can see quite a bit of curvature, so we're going to have to be careful when we have some time variations in given regions, what and how we make sense of a given observation. So that's a non-trivial problem. But it's just intrinsic to general relativity. That doesn't, there's nothing special about us trying to do some numerics. Okay, so yes?
Is that an equation for like, a differential equation that determines the radiation?
So that's, I mean, that's an excellent question. It depends. Depending on the application, we might want to see that as something that determines the foliation, and we're going to ask for guidance in how to choose this. We might try to minimize the acceleration of observers, et cetera, but that will depend on the particular application. So at the moment, we're keeping everything as formal as possible, and then when we discuss particular applications, we're going to take advantage of our ability to choose the laps and the shift, which are, remember yesterday, we're going to define this again, but this NA can be written as alpha ddt plus beta I, or proportional to this way, in this way. Sorry, this, let me just do it. Well, let's get to it in a second. So we're going to be able to attach the laps and the shift to the normal. And by us, remember, these are freely specifiable functions. We can come up with particular ways of for alpha and beta as we go through spacetime that will govern n and therefore will govern this acceleration. So now we want to keep pressing on our framework to try to see how these Einstein's equations are to be seen from this point of view. And so now what we want to do is be able to have the appropriate set of tools to discriminate between things that go orthogonal to or normal to the space-like hypersurface or intrinsic to the space-like hypersurface. So given a general vector, we want to be able to express it as a combination of things. And let me just first tell you what we're doing. So again, let me just keep making the connection with what you would have in special relativity. If I had a vector, let's say a vector A to give, say, by some function phi along the time direction, and some vector A in the space director. These are things that you would have seen when you're dealing in electromagnetism with the potential vector form. It makes sense to say, what is the time component of this vector? What is the space component of this vector? And there was a direct correspondence between us saying these are the space component of the vectors. They are tangential to this hypersurface. And this is the time component, this is the component that goes orthogonal to the hypersurface. We just now want to capture that in geometrical terms that would be completely general, but capture that idea. So we're going to introduce a projector, or a set of projectors, that will give us, given any general vector or any general tensor that lives in the space-time, will allow us to take projections and produce or give to us the components of that vector or tensor that lies tangential to the hypersurface, orthogonal to the hypersurface, or mixed. So the first projector operator that we're going to say, that we're going to use for, is the trivial one. Suppose you have a vector that lives in the full four-dimensional space-time. If you want to just look at what is the component that is normal to the hypersurface, then you just take the product, the dot product, or the contraction of that vector with the unit normal to the hypersurface. That picks up the amount that goes along the direction orthogonal to the hypersurface. And the projector can be defined in different ways, and the standard way which comes, which is useful for purposes that will come clear later on, it's going to be convenient to define, if you are talking with a contravariant vector, or to project it with a minus sign, but if you're doing with a dual vector, or with a covector, you're doing it with a positive sign. this complete, there is complete freedom in doing that, and this would come in handy. And the reason between, one reason of using minus and plus is, remember, the n with the index up there or down there picks up a minus sign in one case with respect to the other one. So we just pick the different signs so that we have something at the end of the day that doesn't, that has a consistent sign. So that's a way to pick, given a vector, the component that is orthogonal to the hypersurface. We need another projector to pick the components tangential to the hypersurface. And we're going to introduce this notation, kind of this kind of upside down T, which will stand for our projector, which is defined in this way. And we'll see why it's defined in this way in a second. It's defined as a delta plus this combination of the unit normal vector. And you can see immediately that this will kill any component that the field, that any arbitrary tensor will have along n. The reason for that is that if you take any vector, in particular, let's take the vector n, so n should be 0 because n is parallel to itself, and if it has no components orthogonal to it, so we should have, if we project, we should have 0. So if you do a projection by this notation would mean we're going to project everything that comes to the right of it. So the projection of this vector n is given by this operator acting on the vector n. So when we act, which is using this in here, which is a delta plus the n, when n acts or is multiplied by delta, it produces an na, because b and b get contracted. And this one produces a contraction of nb with nb, which gives us minus 1 times na. So that's na minus na, which is a 0. And so this is going to be something that we can use to just completely project things on the space of the hypersurface. So for example, if you have a general tensor, let's say SABC, that has components all over the place, we can make sense of the full projection of that tensor by including as many projectors as free indices that we see. So here I see three indices, 1, 2, 3, I have to project every single one of them, and the result of this operation picks up the spatial components of that tensor with respect to this foliation. And the useful thing is that because we're doing things geometrically, we're not relying on someone using this particular time coordinate, this particular space-like hypersurface, any two of you could choose two different ends. With respect to two different hypersurfaces, one vector might have a component that is time-like, while the other one might not. Say you choose this hypersurface versus a hypersurface that goes like that. But both of you can be doing the calculations in exactly the same manner. This is a generic notation. Another useful thing that this projector has is that if we have all indices down or indices up, what we have in the left-hand side is the metric, the three metric on the hypersurface, the three metric on this sigma t. And we can see this in different ways, but one is, for instance, to convince yourself that if you look for any component here that is in the space direction, we're going to get a 0 simply because this na and b, because of the normalization, has chosen such as it will kill any, say, g0, I or G00 component after we do this addition. Okay, so that is the projector that we'll use in all the calculations that comes next. What we're after, again, is at the end of the day be able to rewrite these equations in a way that is consistent with this framework. And once we're done, I'll tell you there is a surprise at the end, which we're going to have to wait for that. Okay, so now we have introduced two ways to project things either on the direction parallel to the normal direction to a given hypersurface or tangential to a given hypersurface. We know that in here there is a lot more information. In particular, there are covariant derivatives. So we need to now do the same thing because, again, our game is at the end of the day have something that only relies on what's going on a given hypersurface and how that hypersurface moves or is embedded in the larger dimensional space-time. So just as we define projectors of tensors, we also need to worry about projections of derivatives. So let's assume that, for instance, in the full spacetime, you have the covariant derivative given by nabla A. Now we want to make sense of the derivative on the hypersurface. And I claim that if we just project this in an appropriate way, and we'll discuss what that appropriate way is, the derivative that you get is, interestingly, the appropriate derivative associated with that hypersurface. Remember, we define the unique, in the torsion-free case, we've defined the unique covariant derivative in a given spacetime that has a given metric as that derivative that satisfies this property. Okay, so that's the one in the right-hand side, the one we're using the covariant. Now, we said yesterday that we're working in a framework where now everything is induced on particular hypersurfaces, and that hypersurface is a truly bona fide manifold in itself. It's just one dimension lower, and the metric in that hypersurface is given by the Gij. What we'll see is that this is also true. So if this is the three-dimensional metric induced on the hypersurface, this derivative operator, which we'll denote with capital D, is the covariant derivative associated with that metric. So it is the metric. This is the covariant derivative you would have calculated if the only thing you knew was that you were on a manifold that was three-dimensional and the metric was Gij. And in particular, because that's the correct one, we know exactly how to write this derivative in terms of partial derivatives and Christoffel symbols associated with that metric, exactly as we know in here what to do. So operationally, the way this derivative is defined with respect to the derivative, the covariant derivative on the larger, on the one extra dimensional space that where this hypersurface is embedded, is just by doing appropriate projections of the free indices. So if we are want to calculate the gradient with respect to this three derivative, in terms of the R1, we just take the projection. We see one free index. That means we have to project that index, and that's what we do. If we have a spatial vector field, well, it's spatial because, remember, this derivative is a derivative that only lives on the spatial hypersurface. It can only know how to take derivative of vectors that are truly spatial. So whenever D acts on a spatial vector field omega, or W, we see two, we're going to denote it with the projector with respect to the derivative on the full space time. And what we see is that we have two free indices, and so the relationship is, for that is, we have the covariant derivative in the full space time has to be projected twice, one for each individual free index. And this is just one simple example, this is what I claim, that we can prove that this D is the true covariant derivative of the induced metric Gij. We're going to use this notation, this Gij, so that we can see easily that when we're talking about the full metric or the metric of the hypersurface, we're going to call this gamma in many instances. So what this line is D of gamma equal to zero. Okay, so then we have to project. We know now, using this rule, extended to a tensor, we have to project this, which means you have to project the grad. The gamma BC is given by the full metric plus this combination of the unit vectors, normal vectors. We have to project. We know that this grad acting on GBC is equal to zero. So regardless of the number of projectors we have, we're going to have a zero contribution when grad acts on G. But when grad acts on N, we have to consider that projection. And that's a projection of this combination. And that one, you can see is zero because of the argument that this is, I'm going to go up. So if you use the fact that, let me just do it in a different way. Let me do it this way. So this is the projection of this. Notice that, okay, this one has three indices, B, A, and Z. And so we need to put one projector for each index. But this projector is such that if ever hits an n, it gives a zero by definition, right? Because there is going to be a projector, so let me just expand that out. So if I have the full projection of NA grad B and C, say, by operation, what I have to do is grad A alpha grad B beta, or sorry, projector C delta of N alpha grad B grad beta and delta. Okay, so these guys will give me something, but as soon as this one hits this one, we have a zero. So we can ignore everything else and then just notice every time we see a projector hitting an N or contacting with an N, we have a zero directly and we don't have to worry anymore. Okay, this is just a one-line proof then that this D defined as a projector of the nabla is the proper derivative on the hypersurface. And this is what we said before, given that we see this gamma, or the metric induced on the hypersurface, as a true bona fide derivative metric of the submanifold sigma, everything that we know applies, except that now we're thinking of a three-dimensional manifold. So still, the commutator of the derivative of a vector or a covector is related to the curvature. But in this case, it's a Riemann associated to the three-dimensional space given by sigma. And because that one is purely special, it's satisfied that the contraction of this one with any n gives us a zero. And that Riemann tensor satisfies all symmetries that we know from the Riemann tensor. And so we can define the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scatter in exactly the same way. So again, I'm not going through all the calculations. I just want you to make sure that we follow the main details here. So again, but our end goal is to be able to rewrite Einstein's equations in a way that is consistent with the framework we're building. So one particularly useful property is to realize that the projection of the grad n of the nabla of n is a totally symmetric tensor. So this, the anti-symmetrization of the grad of n is equal to zero. And now you can prove, again, just by keep pressing with the property. So if you see grad of n and you want to project, you have to we see two free indices. We have to put one projector per index. That's grad c of n d. And then you begin to act. So when I act with these two on that one, I have grad a of n b. When I act with the mixed one terms, I have this one. And when I act with the last one, I have this, I have this term. And what we also know is that the n was unit normal. So every time we see something like this, what do you think is the answer, is the result of this operation? So we're taking the grad of n and hitting it with n. Remember, we define n to be normal, so this is satisfied to have unit length. So if I have that true for all possible at any given point, then what is this? Yes. And this is zero simply because I can bring this the same as grad A of NB NB minus, so I'm using Leibniz, so this is grad A of NB NB, right? So the grad of NB and NB is this one plus that one. This one is zero because the grad of a constant is zero. This one is exactly equal to that one, because once I have two indices pair up, I can change the order. So then this term is exactly equal to that term. So what we have is 2 NB grad A of NB is the grad A of NB and B, but it's zero. Okay, so that's another useful result that quite often comes up. So we use that here and there, and there, these two are zero, and then we just have this relationship that says, if you project the grad of N, we have two components, we can write it as the grad of N plus another contribution due to the acceleration and N. Remember, this projection says the result at the right left-hand side has to be purely special. You are projecting everything on the special hypersurface. So this will be made up by the grad of N, the general grad of N in the full spacetime, plus a piece that exactly kills the part that is orthogonal to the hypersurface. So, as I said, this document has every single step derived, so this is what we just discussed. So let me just say something else. Something we can use with the observations, the early observations, is that this acceleration, so I'm just, again, pointing out main results here, this acceleration is directly related to the laps, and this is, I think, Sebastian, was your question, or is related to your question, that now we see directly the acceleration of the hypersurface connected with this lapse function that we defined by hand. And so now we can say, well, if I choose the lapse in an appropriate way, I can make sense of the acceleration of this hypersurface. In particular, if the lapse is a constant, that derivative is zero, and the acceleration is zero, which is the example we were talking before, where the lapse was equal to one, for instance, and constant throughout. And again, there are ways to defining the lapse that will be guided by this observation. We know it has to do with the derivative of the, or the acceleration of the hypersurface. So this is the extrinsic curvature that we defined yesterday, just the relationship between the extrinsic. So if you take the grad of n has two components, something given by the acceleration and a purely symmetric space vector, a space tensor, a space-like tensor, which is the what we define as the extrinsic curvature, this KAB. Okay, so what do I want to say about this? Let me just skip these details. These are things that we discussed yesterday. So let me get to the meat of the problem. We now, again, we recognize that in here, in Einstein's equations, is the Ricci tensor, the Riemann tensor of the full spacetime. Here, what we're trying to do is rewrite this in terms of things that are purely intrinsic to the hypersurface and some are extrinsic things that relate to how this hypersurface is embedded in the full dimensional space. So we have the feeling, at least the intuition, that we also need to work with the Riemann just to be able to rewrite these equations. And so there is this famous relationships that are called the Gauss-Kodaty equations, and actually there is Gauss-Kodaty minority equations because there is an extra equation that actually comes very useful, where you actually take kind of that attitude to say, okay, I already work to re-express this metric in terms of, again, I'm just rewriting what we had before, gamma AB. So this is, in a sense, the projection or the decomposition of the original metric that was a full four-dimensional metric into some functions and in a three-dimensional metric or a metric on the the three-dimensional hypersurface. We want to do the analog thing for the Riemann tensor. So we want to project the Riemann tensor of the full dimensional space or the full manifold into things that are purely spatial, purely normal, and maybe some mixed components as well to rewrite everything in terms of things we can make sense in a different way. So we're just going to keep applying this projector operator or the two notions of projections that we have along N or along the space. So, for instance, we can wonder what's going to happen if we have a spatial vector multiplying a fully projected Riemann tensor on the space-like hypersurface. And so then by that, we just plug ahead with the definition. So we just consider this is, so we can prove that if we project, because this is spatial, it's intuitively, when it hits any component here, the only thing that will survive is the spatial component in that tensor, because this one is purely spatial. So the B, which is purely spatial, times the projection of R is the same as projecting the product of these two, because B, again, is purely spatial. And so then by manipulating using the symmetries of the Riemann tensor and using the definition of the Riemann tensor with respect to the full spacetime, you just rewrite this in terms of, well, the covariant, the commutator of the derivative of the vector. And by using the fact that you know that this vector is spatial, that therefore this product is zero, and the full expression of what is the projection of the grad of that vector, you can end up with a, let me just, oops. What do you want to do? Oh, interesting. You end up with this relation, which says if you fully project the Riemann of the full dimensional metric, or the full four-dimensional metric, that means, again, if you're considering only the components of the Riemann tensor, of the full Riemann tensor, which are tangential to the hypersurface, these can be rewritten in terms of, this is the Riemann tensor of the metric gamma, not of the metric G, right? This is just intrinsic to the hypersurface. This guy, you never need to know that you're in a higher dimensional spacetime. If I give you the hypersurface, I give you the metric, and I tell you calculate the Riemann tensor, you will give me this. But this one is from the full spacetime, so now there is something missing, and that portion that is missing comes from the extrinsic curvature. And again, this is why these k's that we introduce are known as extrinsic curvatures, because kind of complete the information of the curvature at the space-like hypersurface that relates the Riemann tensor you calculate on the with the metric gamma, the one you compute with the metric g. You restrict everything to this components tangential to the hypersurface, then this is the missing piece. So we're beginning to get in the right direction, because now if we were writing Einstein's equations, say if Einstein's equations were given by the Riemann tensor, we are now able to write things that with respect to curvature of gamma, plus how the extrinsic, this hypersurface is embedded in the full dimensional spacetime. So this is what we're after. We're after rewriting things in the full four-dimensional point of view in between the as a components or terms that can be calculated in the three-dimensional point of view or in the hypersurface point of view. But of course, that's not all the information that is contained in the Riemann tensor, and it's not all the information that goes into Einstein's equations. We also need the components that are off the hypersurface of the full Riemann tensor. So we're going to keep pressing ahead with projectors, and now we're going to consider, well, suppose I now look for the component of the Riemann tensor that has one component orthogonal to the hypersurface and the other three parallel to the hypersurface. So you just, again, plow ahead. This one has an end, that means we're hitting that component with the end vector that picks up the component of R in the first slot along the normal direction, and we want the other three, all the three remaining ones, to be projected to the space-like hypersurface. So again, you just use the definitions. So this is, by definition, is the grad, the commutator of the grad, and here, again, you can use that grad C and V is related to the extrinsic curvature in this way. Just plow ahead, simplify a few terms, and what we find out here is that now the Riemann tensor with one component along the normal and the other three along the space-like on the hypersurface can be re-expressed in terms of this, which are covariant derivatives on purely living on the three hypersurface of the extrinsic curvature. So that takes care of another one. And we have the feeling that it should be another one, one more, where we connect three of them. I mean, sorry, we have two of them normal and two of them spatial. We cannot have three of them normal because of the symmetries of the Riemann tensor will just give us zero. So that's the most we can have, is two normals and two space-like. And that's the last piece of the puzzle. But already with this one, with these two, we can make sense of something called the constraint equations. And this has to do with, let me just go back to an example we had yesterday. Remember we said, okay, we're familiar with Maxwell's equations written this way. Maxwell's sign. But we also know that the covariant way is somehow one has to go from here to there. And this will be one of your, as I said, one of your homeworks will be an analytical or just pencil and paper homework will be related to this and another set of equations to say, well, go from here to here. And from here, you're going to see, you notice that this one, I have only one free index here because this one is hitting that one. So I can ask, what is the component that is normal to the hypersurface of this equation and what is the component that is tangential to the hypersurface? When you do that, you're going to see that what this reproduces, say, these two, and the other one, these two. Or by, yeah, so one constraint and one evolution equation for one and the opposite for the other one. So we now have obtained what is something that is purely special and spatial and purely spatial, but one which is normal. So let us define a few more things because we're going after. Again, we have in our mind still this equation. So we're going to introduce now some definitions which are intuitively related to things we want to compute. Suppose we have a stress energy tensor. So we're studying Ansys equations coupled to some energy source, which is not vacuum, so it's not gravitational waves. But it's, say, some configuration of fluid or some electromagnetic fields that are producing, giving rise to some source of energy. We're going to define the purely normal component of the stress energy tensor, that is, the stress energy tensor multiplied or contacted by the projector along the end in both slots. That we're going to define it as rho. Again, if you think again on the analogy of with special relativity, say, where this n is just one along the time direction and zero in the special, so this will just be picking up the T00 component, and that's usually the density measured by a local observer. If we instead project one direction along the normal and the other one on the space-like hypersurface, we have something called, which is the current, and again, you can see it's related to the standard or the intuitive definition of a current, given the motion of some field that is, has some stress energy tensor associated to it. And we're going to define this other tensor as SAB, which is a purely special component. So we project both indices on the space-like hypersurface. Okay, so now let's try to project a few more things because hidden here we no longer have the Riemann tensor, we have the Ricci tensor as well as the Ricci scatter. So we just can use the definition and we say the projection of the Riemann tensor, of the Ricci tensor, is the projection of the contraction of the metric, the full metric times the Riemann tensor in the appropriate way. Or the, and then we can use the fact that G, written in terms of the three metric, and the n is given by this expression. And what we see here is that this, for instance, is projecting two components of the Riemann tensor along n. And this one will eventually be projecting the components on the space-like hypersurface. So generically, we can write now the following relation. So let me just write it this way. Where is it? Well, let me just keep the punchline at the end. So let's just for simplicity, let's go back. Let's take Einstein's equations, and we're going to use some of the results. Contract the Einstein tensor with the n, which is equivalent to contracting the different components of the Ricci tensor and this component or this metric with the n. you're going to see, and that's equal to a pi tab with the n's. And this is what we just defined by rho. By using the Gauss, well, first, the standard, or using the relationship between, which, well, let me just, I'm running out of time, so I want to just discuss this in a second. So we can, just by plugging ahead, so this is going to be the purely normal component of the Ricci tensor. Here we just have, this is minus 1, so this we have plus 1 r. We can use this relationship that we just obtained to now replace things that we have calculated. So for instance, the purely spatial component of the Riemann tensor can be written in terms of the Riemann tensor of the three-dimensional hypersurface plus extrinsic curvature multiplied by this g's, because that's the trace we're taking. And then by using that g can be written in terms of the gammas, you can find out that this gives you the Ricci scalar associated to the metric of the Ricci tensor you would obtain just with a full three-dimensional metric living on the hypersurface. This gives you k squared, the trace of the extrinsic curvature square, minus this particular combination. And if you take, let's see, so this you can then rewrite in terms of this way, just there is a 1/2 floating around, which then means that now that component, the normal component of that equation, of this equation, projected and written in terms of quantities that we define within this framework, provides you this equation. That says the Ricci scalar plus k squared minus this product is equal to 16 pi rho. So the first observation is, notice here, remember, if we say that our basic variables are the g and the k, or the gamma and the k, so the intrinsic metric to the hypersurface and the extrinsic curvature of that hypersurface, this equation has no time derivative. It says if you know it, if you know g and k at one given hypersurface, this has to be satisfied. We don't care how this hypersurface or how the sequence of hypersurfaces will behave off or away from this particular hypersurface that we choose, any one of them. This equation has to be satisfied. This is analog to this. If I give you the magnetic field at any given moment of time, it has to satisfy the divergence of B equal to 0. There is no information there about what happens later or earlier. There is no time derivative here. And this is, as here, this, remember this word called constraints. That says that this one, if I give you a B and an E, you could use these equations to evolve to the future, but I won't give you a solution to Maxwell's equations unless, in addition to this, you're satisfying these two equations. The same thing happened here. If you have a G and a K, they can only be solutions of Einstein's equations the necessary conditions to be solutions of Einstein's equation is to satisfy this equation. We're going to have other equations as well that he has to satisfy, but this would be one of them. If instead of taking G or the Einstein's equations both indices projected along the normal, we take one projected along the normal and one projected tangential to that, and using the second Gauss-Kodaczy equation that we found, what you find is the following, is now the covariant derivative of the K minus AB minus the covariant derivative of the trace of K is equal to A pi J, where this J is the J we define, the current. And again, if you look at this equation, there is no time derivative here, so it's another constraint. It's again just like one of this one. We don't need to worry, or do we not need to care at all of what is happening off the hypersurface if you give me the G and the K, or the gamma and the K. And if it is true, a true solution of Einstein's equations, he has to satisfy that regardless of what is going to be going on with them away from that hypersurface. So this would be the analog of the constraints. Again, notice what we did. The crucial thing here is that we were projecting along the normal, at least one component along the normal to the hypersurface. And I promise, so this you might want, if you choose to do this homework, I promise that if you take these equations and you project it along the normal, what you're going to obtain is these equations. If you instead, if you project it along the space-like direction, you're going to get these equations. And that's what we need to do in order to complete the story. Because here we have only looked at a subset of Einstein's equations. We're looking at the normal-normal component and the normal-spatial. We need to look at the spatial-spatial component of Einstein's equations, and for that, we're going to have to project this in the spatial direction in both components. For that, we should still need to introduce a little bit more notions that we didn't have to do before because there weren't, at the end of the day, no time derivatives involved. Now is where the time derivatives will show up, as I promised that in this case they show up here for this equation. Have you guys seen Lie derivatives? Okay, so we're going to use that. So there are some basic properties of Lie derivatives. So just read them if they're just standard properties. And what I want to do is get to this. So you notice that this is one important result. You're going to be able to prove. So say you go along the normal direction, and this is the first Q thing that is going to show up. If you go along the normal direction, we have defined the vector n, you can prove that if you take the Lie derivative of along the normal, but not with the vector that is the normal, but the vector defined by the lapse time the normal, of the projector, you get a zero. So that's going to be very convenient because we can then either take the projector inside or outside some operations, because then the operation, the effect of the Lie on the projector will be zero. So anything we derive, I mean, it's sometimes going to be convenient to put it in or out. And so this is what is proved here, that the Lie derivative along this n, and we choose to name it capital N as a vector because it's not just the unit normal vector, but it's a vector, the unit normal vector multiplied by the lapse. It's also going to be true, this operation will be true, if not just with respect to this vector defined as alpha times n, but also defined by alpha times n plus any other purely special vector, and this is the shift we introduced yesterday. So there's going to be the freedom, depending on how and what we're studying, that it may be easier to iterate along this vector or to iterate along a judicially chosen beta shift vector. So we're going to usually just try to refer at the end of the day things with respect to this combination, because then we're going to be able to take advantage of the shift if we ever need it. Given that choosing shift equal to zero corresponds to the other case, this is more general. So what I said is we need this last equation. That's why I typically, or in some case, you'll find the Gauss-Kodaty minority. This is the minority equation, which says, okay, now we want to start with a full Riemann tensor and project two of them in the normal direction and everything else in the tangential direction. So again, you just plow ahead using appropriate definitions. So here, for instance, in this step from going from here to here, you're using the fact that grad C and B and A can be written in this way. Well, actually, first you have a commutator. And then, let me just stress the main result is the following. If you take the Riemann tensor, the full Riemann tensor, you dot two of those two of the components with the n, but the other two are spatial, you have this relation. And now it's the first time we see a time variation, something that knows or needs to know what's going on off a given hypersurface. This component of the Riemann tensor has a few pieces, so this is extrinsic curvature, and this is derivative of the lapse, that only care what's going on at that given hypersurface, but it has this extra piece, which has to do with how the tensor K changes off the hypersurface, how it relates the K, the extrinsic curvature of this hypersurface with one of the neighboring hypersurface. And so Einstein's equations, or the evolution equations, are hidden here, just as the evolution equations for Maxwell's equations are hidden, were hidden in this space-like component. So this is just a few more calculations, and then this is the last thing. Okay, so now you recall that Einstein's equations are given by GAB, so we need to start with the Riemann tensor take the appropriate trace, and then do the appropriate projection, and this is what you end up with. If you were to calculate the full Riemann-Ricci tensor, do the projection purely on the space component, purely tangential to the hypersurface, the right-hand side is this one, where, again, this Lie derivative of K shows up. And as we said, that's for a very special vector, the vector alpha times n, and any Lie derivative with respect to that, we're going to choose to rewrite it in terms of Lie derivative along a time direction, because now, say this is the normal, it might be more convenient to evolve along a vector that goes like that. So this is ddt, and this is the normal. And again, we're going to make use of this explicitly to avoid some pathologies that we might have in evolving some system. So putting everything together now, we can write down the end. Einstein's equations in this way. So we have two equations that are called constraints, actually two set of equations. This one is only one equation. These are three. These are four equations in total, which do not have any time derivative. This one was just a definition, if you want, of the relationship between K and gamma. Remember that somehow we argue that K basically told you the rate of acceleration or the rate of change of the metric. So that's what we see here, the velocity of change. The rate of change of gamma is given by the Schinzer curvature. For instance, remember, the shift is something we can freely specify. So in particular, if we choose the shift to be zero, that one is gone, and we just have that component. But that was the definition of the extrinsic curvature. The remaining Einstein's equation is given by this one, which actually has a lot of components, because here we're talking about this purely special tensor that lives on the hypersurface, therefore, and is symmetric, therefore it has six pieces of information. So these are six equations here, three here, that's 9 plus 1, 10. Our initial 10 equations that were here have now been transformed into this, let's say, equation 129, 130, and 132, coupled with a definition. Only this one, these two, contain time information, how the behavior on two neighboring hypersurfaces of gamma and k's, and these four are purely given by one hypersurface, or the behavior of one hypersurface. So Einstein's equations, or a full solution of Einstein's equations within this picture is alpha, beta, and gamma have to satisfy all this. One particularly acute observation is that notice that this, if I give you K and I give you gamma, I don't have to tell you what Lapsen shift is. Regardless of what the Lapsen shift functions are, these two equations have to be satisfied. So these constraint equations couldn't care less about what you have defined for Lapsen shift. Of course, these two sets of equations do. Let me motivate a little bit of what is it that we are obtaining, and why is it in the end we work so hard to go and express things in this way. In particular, we have the feeling that if we did things the right way, we should recover things that are most, which are familiar with, in particular, kind of making a nice connection with Newtonian mechanics. So let me look at this equation, just this equation in particular. So at least we here have the source. Remember, there was an equation, or the main equation to determine the gravitational potential of a given distribution of matter is Laplacian of phi. It's proportional to rho, where this is the gravitational potential field. Solving this equation gave you the potential due to a given source. So let's see if this one, I claim that this one has that information. So let's kind of try to make contact with that. So if we were in a relatively flat spacetime, where the curvature is not too huge, something we can imagine is that these hypersurfaces are to first order flat. To second order, they are not. But the first order, let's say they are flat. So I'm going to ignore this k squared and this. So these are just, let's say they vary very little between one hypersurface and the next one. So I just have the equation, Ricci scalar of the three metric is equal to rho. So what is the Ricci scalar? Well, the Ricci scalar is a god-awful mess if you want to calculate. But we can say, well, let me keep pushing the analogy or the simple setup. So we can say that gamma ij, say for all intern purposes, is almost flat. So I'm going to write it like that. And in here, I'm going to put the potential, the gravitational potential, in that way. If you, and this is going to be an exercise, if you compute the Ricci of this, the Ricci scalar of this metric, you find out that this is essentially the Laplacian of phi. So this equation basically says, or is hidden in the right, for the right setup, Laplacian of this conformal factor, the only factor that will contain the information of the curvature, is equal to rho, which is the equation that we would expect in Newtonian dynamics. So now we say, well, we're done. We could, if you give me a gamma and a k that satisfy these equations, I can evolve this one and obtain a gamma and a k later. So we have to worry about two things here. And for that, let me draw again a comparison with electromagnetism. He said, suppose you have here your initial hypersurface. You give equations that says dv equals 0. Again, let's imagine that we are in the source-free case. That defines consistent initial data for your electric and magnetic field, and you want to obtain what the electric and magnetic field are at a later time. So I claim that you would do the following. You're going to evolve using this prescription, and you're going to obtain a solution here. But remember I said that in order for E and B to be solutions of Maxwell's equations, they have to satisfy all the equations. So in principle, there is no guarantee that if you, or a priori, if there is no guarantee you give me initial data to satisfy this constraint, you evolve with this rule that doesn't care about these guys, you're going to obtain here an E and a B that satisfy these constraints, right? It doesn't have to be obvious at all. But you can prove that this is the case. If you say, I'm going to give initial data to satisfy that, I can ask a question, what's going to happen with dt of div e if I'm evolving e and b with these equations? So that's a valid question you can ask. But it takes not much effort to convince that it will be satisfied. So let me just commute derivatives here between the divergence and the time derivative, so I'm saying that's equal to this one. We're saying we're evolving or updating with this rule, so here I have the divergence of the curl of B, right? I'm just using the evolution equation to re-express what the time derivative of the electric field is, and what is the divergence of a curl, right? So this says that it is sufficient for you to define initial data that satisfies the constraints, and then use the evolution equations because the constraints will be satisfied at a later time. That, in general relativity, is not trivial, but it's true due to Bianchi identities. Bianchi identities guarantee that if you, and this is something we can prove, but actually it takes a little bit more work, that if you give me data, gamma and k, that satisfy this, you obtain or you evolve with these rules, and you re-evaluate the constraints, they will be satisfied. That, numerically, might not be enough for reasons that we'll discuss the last week. But before even I go there, because that's a delicate question in its own, this is the surprise. You went through all these pages, say you rederive everything, maybe one of you gets the $20, and you say, fine, I now have two set of equations that I'm going to evolve in time. And I'm going to use this to evolve and obtain, given some initial configuration, what is going to be the field afterwards. And that's what was done till the late 90s in numerical relativity. Well, unfortunately, we now understand that these equations, after working this hard, are really much crap for numerical implementation. This has to do with a particular problem that we'll discuss this afternoon. Has to do, in order to discuss it, we're going to have to introduce a little bit the concept of characteristics that ties with the discussion of our boundaries. And what happens is these are perfectly fine for analytical work. You can, if you're going to be thinking about, say, quantum gravity or anything where you're never going to put this in a computer, they're pretty decently. But in a computer, you always have to imagine that any sort of perturbation can happen. In particular, perturbations that will violate these conditions. So you're never going to give initial data, say that the constraints are, where the constraints are exactly satisfied. They're satisfied approximately. So it could be that errors now compound because now you have any arbitrary perturbations that will just blow up. It will unfortunately blow up in a non-controlled manner. And this is something we understand now well. We know how to cure it. We have then other formulations. These are things that we're going to discuss in the last week that actually are robust and deal with these problems. That doesn't mean that once you have those equations, everything is a piece of cake. You still have to work hard. But in any ways, I need to show you this. The reason we also solve this is for many reasons. One, in particular, to define consistent data at a given hypersurface, we're still going to use these equations. These equations are just fine. We're going to replace these in evolution equations. But the intuition we build up with this at the analytical level will actually be very helpful in exploiting these other formulations. But I just wanted to mention this. That if you're going to, now we know better than to use these equations to do evolutions. Of course, for these problems that I mentioned, only appear if you have in full 3D and you're looking at very general scenarios. There are plenty of excellent, I mean, top perfect results that have been obtained using these equations in situations where symmetries have prevented these modes from blowing up because they weren't allowed to exist. But that we'll discuss later today. So I'll see you this afternoon. We're going to discuss a little bit of theory, and then we're going to go to the examples and just walk around the desk so as to help you in any way you can you need. Okay, thank you.